Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Emerson famously said, "Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members." My guest today says things have gotten a lot worse since Emerson uttered those words over a century and a half ago. His name is Robert Twigger. We last had him on the show to discuss his book, Micromastery. That's episode number 528, if you want to check that out. Today, we discuss a book he wrote 20 years ago called Being a Man in the Lousy Modern World. We begin a conversation discussing how the modern world infantilizes men so they're easier to control and whether Robert thinks things have changed since he initially published the book. We then dig into the four factors Robert says need to be in place for a man to feel like a man and why experiencing these qualities has become a lot harder to do in the present age. We then discuss what Robert did to counter the currents of modern malaise, like hiking the Pyrenees Mountains and learning a martial art, and whether doing those things actually made him feel manlier. We enter a conversation with what men can do to start fighting back against the conspiracy against their manhood. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Twigger. All right, Robert Twigger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Always glad to be talking to the Art of Manliness.
Well, we had you on the show last year to talk about your book, Micromastery, and that's episode number 528 for those who want to check it out. It's all about learning new skills by thinking small. It's a really great episode. It's a fan favorite. But we're going to talk about a book you wrote almost 20 years ago. It's called Being a Man in the Lousy Modern World. So tell us, what was the impetus behind this book?
The real impetus was at that time, so I was writing that in, I don't know, sort of 1999 or something like that, exactly 20 years ago. There was a whole spate of adverts in which men were portrayed as sort of dorks and patsies, and the women were all smart and sassy. There were commercials in people's homes, you know, and it was the dorky husband who couldn't do anything, and the wife was in control. And I just thought, this is just sending such a stupid wrong message. So it was kind of anger. And then it sort of all kind of spiraled out from there. So I just started to look at what the role of men was in the lousy modern world.
And the way you wrote this, you sort of contrasted, you had a son that was coming.
Yeah.
And you contrasted that, trying to figure out what does it mean to be a man in this world? And then contrasted all these adventures you tried to go on to figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, the other strand in the book was using, because my previous couple of books had been these adventures, but I had all these leftover stuff that I'd done because I was writing for kind of adventure travel pieces for magazines. And so I had all this material. And I thought, well, I've got to use it. Each adventure itself probably wouldn't have justified a book. So I wove that in, and it became, because the adventure seemed part of being a man, you know, it seemed like a man who shunned any form of adventure always, I guess it was because adventure called forth the need for courage. And I knew that courage was a key part of it.
And you can, I mean, it was funny, the contrast between like you getting ready for the arrival of your son, it was sort of like a day in the life of just a regular suburban guy living in the Western world, you know, barbecues. And you're kind of like, the way you described it is like, this is not it.
Yeah. I mean, and I wanted to make it honest, and there's a sort of problem because the kind of language you use to describe adventures it doesn't suit describing relationships and about, you know, what you feel about your kids and all that sort of thing. So it was a fine line to draw. I also didn't want to just, you know, burrow into total sentimentality because, you know, before your kids are born, I mean, what can you feel? They've just arrived, you know, you don't know what they're going to be like. So it was tricky ground. But as you say, yeah, it's half that theme through the book, which I keep going back to, which is as the day progresses, that's the kind of driving force. And it's kind of like a micro adventure in itself, but it's Mr. Suburbia, and my life is Mr. Suburbia, and I'm just not sort of happy with it.
So what is it about the lousy modern world that you felt like that makes manliness feel obsolete? Like you feel like it's not suited for men?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many strands here, but I mean, just coming from the top, it's got to be that we have so many prosthetic devices, computers, cars, things that actually take out the physical aspect. And if there's there are many differences between men and women, but I mean, the most obvious one is there's a physical strength difference. So if you're not actually having to use your physical strength at all, you're different from, you know, most men that have come before you in history. So there's that side. There's the skill aspect, even small skills like learning to light a fire, which my dad used to do, you know, lighting the fire in the house. Even things like fixing the car, she did. I can't even fix my own car now because I don't know how to do the codes into the computerized bit. I mean, it's kind of endless, really, the way we become so impotent, and we're just kind of like living like kings in this world of largely electronic backup.
Well, and I think that one of the points you make that I thought was really incisive is that the modern world does a great job of keeping us like children, even as adults. Like you said, you can't even fix your own car because there's like a computer that you have to be able to program and you have to be licensed to do that change. And you make this point that that children are easier to control than adults. And it's kind of, you could say a cynical conclusion that, well, that's what corporations and governments want. They want us to be easily controlled.
Well, yeah, I mean, it may not be, I don't think there's some kind of conscious uber mind who's saying that let's infantilize our entire population, but it just seems to work out better that way. So maybe there's some sort of evolutionary imperative at work inside corporations and big organizations that gradually the solution that infantilizes the workforce seems to work better. So you kind of, by increments, move towards that position. And it's generally the case, yeah. I mean, even the police, you know, when for example, somebody stands up and defends themselves against a mugging, there's always the warning from the police. The police say, don't do this in future. it's a dangerous thing to try and defend yourself. At the same time as the newspaper report is saying, oh, what a great thing, the 78-year-old guy fought off the mugger. So there's this constant message that you're better off just being like a kid, really.
But the insidious thing is that because of all these advances, like, you know, things are cheap, we've got all this technology that, you know, basically gives us the world at our fingertips, it makes us feel like we're in control, but sometimes we're really not in control.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird idea of control, isn't it? It's a bit like, I mean, we already had it today. When the computer works, you're apparently in control. As soon as it doesn't work, you discover the exact limitations of your control. If you can't fix something, how much can you say you're in control? I mean, I think being able to fix stuff is a key part of being a man. And when we live in a world where we can't fix things very easily, maybe we're just going along on someone else's ride.
Well, yeah, I guess Emerson's right. He said that society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was, 150 years ago, something like that?
Yeah.
It's got to be right, man.
It's got to be. And so you wrote this 20 years ago, and you were seeing this stuff then. Like, how have things changed? Have things gotten worse? Have it stayed the same? Have you seen things get better in some places?
Yeah, it's weird how things have changed. In some ways, it's got a lot worse. Things that I could humorously joke about then, you can't really joke about now because you'll be targeted as somebody, you know, that's not something you can joke about. Things have become off limits. So that's kind of worse. The better side is there's been a growth in things. The art of manliness came along. There's been a growth in people becoming more aware of mental health issues of young men, which is a tremendous problem. So those kind of knowing jokes, oh, it's the men. You know, the other day I was at a party and some woman sort of made some mocking comment about men with respect to mental health. And I was able to sort of pull the, it's a serious subject kind of thing. I didn't have to back off and take it. So there's been a bit of a pushback there, but it's at a big cost. You know, we've seen, I mean, I talk about it in the book. I talk about how criminality is a kind of refuge. It's like the last refuge of masculinity for many men. I mean, if you haven't got much imagination and you can't get yourself off and do a dangerous or interesting adventure, you're probably drawn to criminal behavior. So, you know, we've seen a massive or increasing rise in criminality and, you know, that kind of area and spill over into mental health issues. So in that sense, worse. It's pretty similar though.
So in the book, you lay out you lay out four factors that you think need to be in place for a man to be considered a man. So this is what you said 20 years ago. Might have changed, but yeah. What were those four factors that you saw?
The four factors were killing a beast, courage, courage is one, ability to, you know, certain skills, you know, there were basic skills that, that, you know, seemed to be involved with being a man, and passing a rite of passage. You know, that's something that I circle in the book, which is that men seem to have the need to have undergone some kind of test of difficultness or dangerousness. And it's a before and after, and you see it characterized in, you know, even things like a bar mitzvah or other rites of passage after which you are a man. It's a ritual. And I think that if anything, that's, I mean, just to sort of move on a bit from those four characteristics, that's one of the key issues of the book, is that this lack of ritual in our society means the transition from a boy to a man is blurred or never even exists. So, and I think rituals are the way we make transitions, and we've lost sight of that.
Well, and we sort of still have rituals, but as you point out in the book, they're sort of watered down.
Yeah. There's things like, you know, pass your driving test, you know,
graduate high school, graduate college, yeah, graduate get your first job.
Yeah. And they're lame as hell. I mean, you can't really look at yourself and think, I can stand shoulder to shoulder with, you know, people who were in the First World War, or, you know, single-handedly paddled their way up the Amazon or something. So it's a sort of, you're going to just feel lame if you accept the culture.
Right, they're male rites of passages for this lousy modern world.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, you said this idea, like a rite of passage, it really can help a boy transition that man. It has those factors. There's an element of risk to it, of danger, where you have to display courage, you have to display fortitude. And lacking that, it's just, it's not transformative if there's no risk involved.
Yeah, I think it just sharpens things up, and the ability to assess risk is probably a big part of it. I mean, I know this guy, a good friend, and he told me he's going off to Pamplona to party. And I said, well, you've got to run the bulls if you're going to go to Pamplona. He said, no, that's just stupid. That's stupid. You know, that's kind of like the lousy modern world speaking. You know, you're like Mr. Sensible. And of course, running the bulls has risks. And if you're drunk, the risks are higher. But, you know, you can assess those risks and decide whether you're going to do it or not. Otherwise, don't go to Pamplona, because otherwise you're borrowing the sort of the kudos of Ernest Hemingway and all the people who went there, and you're just going there for a big kind of piss up. And that seemed to be kind of like, you know, another problem, you know. But the problem itself is not the danger, it's the unwillingness to assess it, because again, that's a kind of self-reliance. So I'm not saying do dangerous things for the sake of it, to be stupid. I mean, there are plenty of people who do that. Get some of them get killed. What I'm saying is develop the skill to assess risk. Don't sort of just offload that skill to, you know, looking on the internet and someone tells you, oh, it's dangerous or something.
Well, let's delve deeper into this courage, because you got philosophical about this, like trying to figure out what is courage, because there's some people who look courageous. Like Aristotle, the philosopher, grappled with this idea. It's like, how can you tell if someone's really courageous, right? They could just be like they're crazy. Mm. And they don't feel fear, and they just do crazy stuff. So, I mean, are they really courageous? So, what's your assessment of that?
Well, I think, yeah, Aristotle does mention no courage by its absence rather than by its presence. That's one thing. You talking to people who served in the army in dangerous situations, it's courage is not that rare. You know, there are, you know, most people given the right kind of backup will be courageous. So it's not something we should feel that it's like a really rare quality. It's pretty available to everybody. But I think everybody needs to be able to test themselves in a number of situations, because you're right that mere bravado can look like courage unless someone has felt the consequences. You know, I mean, in the book, I talk about this climbing where when I was younger, I never had any concept of risk. I fell off and cracked some vertebrae in my, it cracked a couple of vertebrae, and then I realized there were consequences, and I stopped being as crazy. And in fact, I didn't really do much climbing after that. So I kind of realized that maybe I wasn't that courageous when it came to heights. So it's finding those, I think that courage is an exploration of finding those points where you push yourself. And again, it's a sort of self-knowledge thing, that without putting yourself in those difficult situations, you won't get that self-knowledge. So maybe even more than courage, what we're looking at here is knowing yourself and knowing what your limitations are. Because I think as I said, most people do have courage, and they are sort of a natural human characteristic.
And I think one of the problems of the lousy modern world, as you put it, is that we don't have that many opportunities to display courage. Like, you have to often proactively go seek it. You know, in times past, that it would come to you. You had to display courage for whatever reason, because the world was a dangerous place, but now it's so safe. You have to go look for it instead of it finding you.
Yeah, you do, really. I mean, there are plenty of opportunities for showing that you're stoical in the modern world, for showing that you can put up with awful shit over a long period. But courage, sort of find out the full kind of topography of courage. I think you do need to be in situations which demand quick thinking, as well as kind of like just endlessly putting up with something. And for that, yeah, you probably have to seek, well, you do have to seek it out, I think. I think you have to get either into the wilderness, or you have to, you know, deny yourself the normal creature comforts and find a bit of a challenge.
Well, let's talk about this idea of being skilled as a component of manliness. I thought it was fun. This was fun reading this because, you know, I had read your book, Micromastery, and we talked about it, and this was 20 years later. So it's interesting to see your thinking of skills being an important part of being a man, even 20 years ago. So what is it about being handy that you think makes a man admirable?
Yeah. Well, I think it's the hands. Yeah, it's using our hands. You know, I think that we know that there's something associated with it. I always remember my grandfather, who was very, I mean, he ended up as an engineer, but he'd started as, you know, doing manual work, building walls and using all kinds of hand tools. He had these really, he was not a big guy, but his hands were big and strong. And that we feel it in the old handshake. You know, why do we set such a store by having a bone-crushing handshake? It's because it kind of means something. It means that you can handle weapons, you can make things, you have the skill to be useful. I think it's all about a utility factor. Nobody wants to feel useless. And I think that there's connection in the lousy modern world between people not finding meaning and people being very, very lazy and not getting off their butt. It's connected to feeling useless. So if you have skills, hand skills, you are useful, and therefore you will work and you will find meaning. So they're all kind of deeply connected. And we know that there's, you know, parts of the brain connected with, you know, getting hand skill are really sort of, if you can use this term, ancient parts of our cognition. You know, this is not a recent development. So I think it's tapping into something that is ancient and valuable. And yeah, I mean, even Neanderthal man, even proto-humans were adept at hand skill. So it seems like an essential thing to master.
And it's one of those ways of becoming more competent. Is one of those ways you can rebel against this conspiracy against your manhood.
Yeah, I think it really is. I think it's a way of it's very satisfying as well. You know, the idea of, you know, you can go into the wilderness and start a fire without using a lighter and petrol. You know, if you can use make a bow drill and start a fire like that. I mean, there's huge growth in survival, which we've seen. I mean, the being a man thing, it already had started in the 90s, but in the last 20 years, we've seen a massive growth in bushcraft and survival, and YouTube has been a huge help there in spreading all kinds of skills. It's now really quite easy to get quite arcane skills, which you had to go on special courses to learn in the past. You can access them through YouTube.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit texaspete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at texaspete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at texaspete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss, we had him on the podcast, Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest, Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
All right, so let's talk about this idea of the ability to kill man or beast. So what's going on there? I think the point you made is that it's something that people, I think, tacitly accept as being, you know, a part of being a man. It's like if you have the capability to do violence, but they're dodgy about it. Like they don't like to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean it's dodgy ground because you're entering the area of the criminal in the modern culture. But if you go back to traditional societies, most of the rites of passages were either you killed a lion or some dangerous beast, or you killed a member of another tribe, but not in the sort of psychopathological warfare of the 20th century. It was probably some kind of raiding warfare. And even tribes like the Nagas, these headhunters in the Burmese Indian border, I spent some time with you. If you ran away, you weren't considered a coward. But if you got killed in a raid, you were given a dishonorable burial, which is quite interesting. So it limited warfare, but it allowed people the chance to get involved. Sometimes, of course, people were killed in those environments, but that the numbers were far, far less than the vast numbers that have been killed in the 20th century. So we can't really boast that our system is more humane or more manageable. So I think that gets rid of that objection. But the hard part is to say that is an aspect, the potentiality of killing somebody. Perhaps the only way around it is to talk about defense, that you are prepared in a situation, to put yourself in a difficult situation and be competent to protect somebody, even if it meant dispatching somebody. It is borderline psycho, though. So that is always going to be the problem. And I think the way around it is to think of this as a skill, which is a kind of bridging between the sort of the past and the present. That if you believe that you couldn't, in a certain situation, if your family was threatened and you had to defend them, if you believed you would just walk away and let them be killed and you wouldn't do something about it, then there's something missing. You know, I think that you need to have that potential and that skill to be able to do that. And probably it's more of a willpower thing. And it's nothing to be particularly proud of, because, you know, thousands of people in this world are going around killing people with, you know, without any thought. You know, a friend of mine told me that he was in Somalia as war reporter. And when he decided that the game was getting a bit dangerous was when a kid, you know, we're talking about a 10-year-old kid, pointed a Kalashnikov and just pulled the trigger. Of course, it was unloaded. So, or the bullet jammed or whatever. Anyway, he was lucky. But that, the ability to just, you know, blow somebody away is not some huge, great skill in that sense. But if you are a rational, calm, normal, and you're not an unhinged human being, then it's quite a leap. So maybe what we're edging towards here is if you are someone who is repelled by the idea of killing and you're normal in that sense, you should make that effort to comprehend it. And I suppose that's what I'm saying. But if you're the sort of person who just can't wait to go and stab somebody, then you're obviously a psychopath and we're not talking about you. So I think that the perspective of the book was really aimed at that thoughtful, perhaps rather suburban character who thinks this is an untenable and outrageous position. And maybe it's all about getting that mental flexibility and moving yourself into that position.
And I mean, something, this is sort of an issue that philosophers have grappled with. It's like, can you really be considered kind or good if you don't have the ability to do like violence or bad or whatever, right? It's like, is it any virtue that you don't even have the ability? Like, you don't have to overcome it.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? So it's like, can you really be proud of your virtue if you had no opportunity to test it or like control it somehow?
Yeah, I think that you know, that's a kind of another way into it. And I think that's a good way of looking at it, that you may be over-focused on those virtues and you might not understand that, well, perhaps they need to be defended in some way and that they may go hand in hand with a lied virtue. I mean, I'm thinking of things like courage and generosity. I've often noticed that people who are very generous are often courageous. And actually, if you read in sort of, you know, traditional type psychology, they're considered to go hand in hand. So if you want to build your courage, build your generosity. So there are some sort of links, maybe at a deeper level, between more passive virtues and the more kind of outgoing, aggressive virtues or borderline vices, depending how you look at them.
Well, you make this distinction too between men being either passive or active. And I think that goes to what you were just saying there. Like men are, I think we have this idea that men should be active instead of passive. And I mean, what does that look like for you in the,
yeah,
and when, well, it plays out?
One of the things I regret not doing in that book was not using the yin yang distinction, which of course was fairly well known, but it wasn't really mainstream. And now I think it is more mainstream. And it's one of the things that has definitely happened over the last 20 years is a lot of the concepts that were a bit borderline then are totally mainstream. Brain plasticity, totally mainstream. Use it or lose it. You know, the idea that if you don't practice these skills, you'll lose them. All of these things are now mainstream. And one of them was yin and yang. And I think that that's the passive-active thing, the sort of yin characteristics. I mean, you know, in the sort of Eastern philosophies, you know, things always have a yin and yang element. And it depends on where on the spectrum you are. And I think they don't necessarily map perfectly onto male and female, but definitely men are more on the yang end of the spectrum and women in general are more on the yin end of the spectrum. And there's a bunch of characteristics that are yin and yang, and passivity is a more of a yin characteristic. It doesn't mean it's better or worse. It's just a characteristic. And so I definitely think that men are more on the yang end and therefore need to do more active stuff.
But another point you make in your book is that the lousy modern world or soft suburban existence can often take men who have that active stance towards the world and then turn them into, like, they become like, they're sort of like guppy fish. They start out male young, and then when they get older, they turn into females.
Yeah, I think that was my great theory that I thought would be taken up, but people just kind of like completely ignored it. But yeah, I thought that the sort of traditional polarity, societies seem to need to organize themselves into polarity, and maybe that reflects the yin-yang thing. And in most cultures, it's male-female, but we now have evolved a young-old polarity. So you're kind of young until you're about 38, and you start making all these references to getting older, and then you suddenly adopt all these kind of timid, older characteristics that are quite yin. And so they're sort of more like old-style feminine characteristics, but you can't call them that now. So it's now just what older people do. So that was, but I think there are all sorts of interesting possibilities. Like, I do think if you trap an active person in a controlled environment, then they become focused on. I mean, we see a growth in not Asperger's syndrome per se, but sort of characteristics, Asperger type characteristics, you know, listing involvement, deep involvement in sort of this sort of hobbies. And I wonder if that's a reaction to being kind of trapped in a non-active environment. You tend not to see that in tribal groups, which still go out hunting and roaming around and generally being kind of hunter-gatherer types. You don't see that same sort of nerdy kind of behavior, which may be a kind of reaction to being sort of penned in.
Well, I mean, that's another thing we've done in our lousy modern world. We've taken being active, sometimes the extreme forms of being active, and we said, well, that's a pathology. Like, they've got ADHD. We're going to give you some medicine for that. Because again, it's all about control. Like, we want to control people.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, if you look at the school is only tangentially about education. I mean, it's really about socializing people to function in this world that does demand a high level of submission to in certain areas. I mean, one of the shocking things I found going around a prison in Scotland where I gave a talk a couple of years ago, and it reminded me of school. I mean, not in a bad way, even in kind of a good way, because the guards were really trying to help the prisoners in a good way. And I was teaching, I was talking to some of the good prisoners who hadn't sort of, you know, messed up. So they were allowed to listen to my talk. And the whole thing was like a hardcore, grim version of school. So it shocked me. And I realized, in other words, those prisoners had just been trained for this environment. This is what they knew by going to school. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's the only function of school, because obviously people do learn things, but they could learn them a lot more efficiently in another way. We know that. But that's not the big issue. The issue is that society needs to control all these people. They can't have them just running around. And just observing that doesn't mean to say that I'm proposing that we disband all these things, but it's just about developing that awareness. And having that awareness doesn't mean that you are automatically opposed to those institutions. I mean, I think that's one of the things I was trying to do in the book, is to build a sense of, you know, be able to hold those slightly contradictory positions in your brain at the same time. Don't assume that you have to be either one thing or the other.
And again, you know, like, the people they're often trying to control are boys. It's like, I mean, usually, usually the schools are what the research says, the way school's set up, it's suited for girls. Boys, you know, some do okay, but then some boys don't do well at all in it, because there's just so much, there's no flexibility. They like to be active and they don't get that at school.
Yeah. I mean, there are just 100 ways that you could improve it, and that we probably go off in a complete tangent, but you're right. You know, we human beings were not meant to sit motionless or not hardly moving in one seat all day long. You know, it's just not what humans are supposed to do. And to expect people to do that is just, it's kind of lunacy.
So you talk about in this lousy modern world, like, we don't have these opportunities to show male attributes, the courage, the ability to be skilled. Like, you have to go out and find it. Like, what are some of the stuff that you did to go display this stuff? And like, were you trying to create a rite of passage for yourself with all these activities you did?
I think what I was trying to do was emulate people who'd come before me. I wanted to you know, I knew that people had fought in wars. I knew that people had gone on expeditions, and I'd read books about them. And I thought, we've got to live up to that. We can't just assume that things were great in the past and we've just got to, you know, all be wimpy nowadays. So it was a conscious trying to emulate people in the past. But starting in a really small way, because I was quite a timid guy. I'm not a sort of Superman who just jumped off. So I think the first thing is this doing a long distance walk in the Pyrenees. So walking alone about 700 kilometers along this couple of trails that connect the Atlantic with the Mediterranean. And that was a big deal for me because it was, you know, self-reliance, you know, some slightly scary situations when I got lost, but, you know, wasn't beyond the ability of almost anybody to do. And then that gave me the impetus to go to Japan and study this martial art. And I'd always known that I wanted to do a martial art. I just not found a situation where I could do one and actually progress and get better because I wasn't that good at it. And then when I got to Japan, I realized you could do it absolutely full on and full time, 5 hours a day, 5 days a week. And that's when I began to properly progress and achieve that sort of bucket list tick, which, you know, get a black belt had always been a kind of, you know, there's a kind of an overlap with the bucket list, I suppose, here. But I'm a big believer, or wish list. I think it's better to call them wish lists. Making a wish list of achievements is no bad thing.
You also went bullfighting, or you?
Oh yeah, yeah. The bullfighting training. Yeah, the cow, famous cow. Yeah, that came about through a men's magazine, a Maxim, I think. And England had a bullfighter called Frank Evans, sadly now dead. And he offered to train me, and I had to go up to Manchester, his town, and we went into the local school playground where he had a shopping trolley with a bale of straw in it, and that was the bull. And I had to practice kind of stabbing it and, you know, lifting the cloak. And yeah, and then we went out to Spain to practice with a cow, because you can't, if you practice with a bull, you have to actually dispatch the bull. And I wasn't really going to do that. So you have to practice with a cow, because then the cow's allowed to live.
And the reason why you have to dispatch the bull is that the bull will learn. Basically, they don't want the bull to learn how to kill humans.
Yeah,
better.
Yeah. I mean, they learn so fast in the 15 minutes that they're in there, because they've been living on the range for 2 to 4 years. So they've had a wonderful life. They haven't been inside a horrid shed for 6 months and then, you know, stunned by one of those guns like they used in No Country for Old Men. None of that. They've had a wonderful life, and it's come to an end in 15 minutes. And quite frankly, if that was the way I was going to go, I wouldn't mind. But yeah, they learn so much, they become very dangerous, and they will easily kill the next matador. So they're dispatched. But cows are considered to be less difficult. But of course, cows learn too. So there is a wild card. And Frank himself had suffered from a terrible injury where a cow had pronged him right up the ass, punctured his bladder, but it had left no damage. So he, you know, it was an internal injury that had no external kind of damage. So it was rather a touch and go nasty thing to happen.
And that sounds unpleasant, though.
It's a deeply unpleasant. I'm just trying not to laugh because it's a horrible thing to happen to anyone. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, we went into it. It was a tiny cow, but still, yeah, pretty scary when it's coming full on at you, and all you've got is a cape and a sword to protect you. But yeah, that was a cool thing, and kind of glad I did it.
Well, and after you did all this stuff, like, did you feel change? Like, did you feel like, I feel like a man? Or was it sort of like, that was a letdown?
I was thinking, reflecting about this the other day, I was thinking, God, yeah, you've done some stuff. You're all right. I think experience has an odd effect on you that isn't explicit. So it doesn't come up as sentences in your head. It's just does change the way you approach life a bit. It makes you, those kind of experiences will tend to make you more confident in unusual situations. You'll just think, ah, oh, this isn't so bad. So that's good. So it gives you a range in which to judge things and some skills which you might need. But it's not that you're not going to feel any different. I think that's the kind of thing when you're a kid, you always think, oh, I'm going to feel different. You're just the same. You know, you're still you, but you're less anxious and you're less anxious, really, and you're more willing to have a go at something. So it's a sort of, it increases your range and the possibilities that you have, but you won't feel like Clint Eastwood inside, whatever he feels like inside.
Have you talked to your son about this stuff as he's gotten older?
Not really. I mean, that's the other thing. I don't think I'm a great dad. So, almost like an okay one. I kind of brought it up, but mostly what I pontificate on is treated as, marginal interest in our household. So, so that's always a problem. But I've the books are there for them to read. My daughter read it. I think she gets it better. That's the other paradox, of course. Yeah, you spend all this effort thinking you're talking to your son and you may well be talking to your daughter. So things work in mysterious ways.
What did she get about the book? Like, what did she say, like, what connected with her on that?
Yeah, what she got, and I think I can see it, is she's tolerant of all kinds of different... She can see what masculine behavior is important and what isn't, and what is just like what men do. She's used to... She's not one of these women who demands men to all kind of act as if they're, downtrodden and passive. She's more able to respond to what they're actually saying or doing rather than what she might imagine they are. Because there are quite a lot of, especially if you go to college now, there are kind of a lot of, behavioral norms that men are supposed to adhere to, which obviously not everyone does.
Yeah, there's like classes now when you get, you start your freshman year where you have to talk about like what you're supposed to do and not do.
Yeah. I know it's so weird. It's making this whole area of tacit communication where you should know already. It's kind of trying to make it all explicit, and it's a really bizarre kind of move. But yeah, I mean, I'm not envious of them.
Okay. You're not there, but like, what do you think men who are listening to this podcast can start doing to experience what you call enhanced male being? Like, what are the takeaways?
Apart from buying the book.
Still in print?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely out. That's the thing. The imprint thing doesn't, there's quite a few secondhand copies out there, especially if you go to the Amazon UK site. So I think you can still get it. It may still be in print. I don't know, because it was on a reading list at British Columbia and Simon Fraser University. It was on their masculinity course as a kind of academic text for a while. So I think it still has a life out there. You probably will be able to get a copy. But yeah. Okay, that aside, what could you do? I think there's far more resources out there. And I think, I've got into this practical wisdom. There's this sort of website on University of Chicago. It's kind of movement, practical wisdom, which is sort of moving away from rules and incentives and trying to ground behavior in experience. And I think that's a way of sidestepping, compartmentalizing and labeling, which I think is, has been part of the problem. But yeah, in general, I would say you've got to honor your yang. I mean, I say this to my friends, I've got to yang up. I mean, the other day I was going to join this gun club. And of course, shooting guns in the UK is pretty difficult. But it's just it's a yang experience to go out, shoot off a few rounds. It's ultimately maybe you go hunting, maybe you don't go hunting, but it definitely clocks you up a bit more yang, and you come out feeling a little bit more alive and a bit more energized. So I would generally say yang up, find yang type activities, chopping wood. It's been shown that even if you're 80 years old, you go out and chop wood, your testosterone levels rise to that of a 30-year-old. I mean, jogging won't do that for you. Find out those activities that do give you that kind of use aggression. I mean, aggression has a function, which is to use tools or weapons in a fast and efficient way. So you don't lose it. I mean, you've and don't necessarily get into all those kind of endurance sports like riding your bike for 5,000 miles. You've got to have a variety, I think, of activities.
Well, Robert, where can people go to learn more about your work?
Well, I've got a website, robertswigger.com, with about 1,000 articles on it of all kinds of stuff. I mean, as you know from the last chap, my kind of the area I'm mainly into is polymathy, which is being skilled at many different things. I think that that my being a man thing was just a sort of subset of the whole polymathic impulse, which I think is, as men and women, I think we all need to spread our wings and not be trapped into specialization.
Well, Robert Twigger, thanks for his time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett. Been great.
My guest today was Robert Twigger. He's the author of several books. The book we discussed today was called Being a Man in the Lousy Modern World. It's available on Amazon.com, but you got to go to the UK version of Amazon. It's not available in the States. Also, check out his website, roberttwigger.com, and check out our show notes at aom.is/Twigger, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM Podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years about pretty much anything you can think of. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM Podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying new episodes of the AOM Podcast ad-free. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to the AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.